Like to call a meeting to order of the Ag Policy Committee. And again, already falling behind on our wish list of beginning on time. We're close, about a minute, so we'll survive on that. As folks keep coming in, we hope more folks keep coming in. On today's agenda, we have an informational meeting. We will have folks from the DNR make a presentation, and then also we'll hear from a couple of people representing the Irrigators Association in Minnesota. A little background on where we're at today. Legislation passed back in 2012 called for the DNR to establish three pilot projects, three areas in the state, to really take a close look at the groundwater. And the idea behind that was to ensure groundwater sustainability in these areas and also throughout the entire state. The areas were in the North and East Metro, up in the Park Rapids area, and then an area that is in the district that I represent, Bonanza Valley, up in the Bruton-Belgrade area in west central Minnesota. And I've been at a couple of the monthly meetings in that area. They've been interesting. DNR has put those meetings on, and I believe they've also had members from PCA and the Department of Ag at those meetings, and a group that was expanded to about 20 interested parties, farmers, people in the irrigation business and such are members of the advisory team, at least in the Bonanza Valley with what I'm more familiar with. So the meeting's off to a predictable and good start, but we're going to hear the update today from the DNR and then also hear from the irrigators and their take on this process. But again, this all comes about because of legislation passed back in 2012 that its attempt is to ensure the sustainability of our very valuable groundwater in Minnesota. Now, I've been informed we do have a quorum, and Mr. Schumacher, have you had a chance to check? We have two sets of minutes, one from January 15th, one from the 14th. On your advisory, we would like to approve those minutes, Representative.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move both those minutes.
Thank you. Motion made. All in favor of approving both sets of minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Minutes of both meetings have been approved. We'll get underway now this morning, and first of all, have the DNR come up and give their presentation on their role in this really new legislation. So if the DNR is ready, we say welcome, and please identify yourself for the record, and hopefully things technically will work, and then begin your presentation. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jason Meckel, I'm the Inventory Monitoring and Analysis Section Manager for the Department of Natural Resources in the Division of Ecological and Water Resources. Really appreciate the opportunity to come and talk about groundwater management and the topic that you were just talking about, Representative Anderson. The groundwater management is where I'm going to finish up the latter part of the presentation, but to set that up, I want to talk about groundwater management and what it is that we're understanding about groundwater in the state of Minnesota and the interaction of groundwater and surface water resources. And then a very short primer about what the statutes say, our legislative, or what our responsibilities are here at the DNR. And then I'll talk a bit about how we're collaborating with other members of the executive branch agencies in this work, because as we all know, there's a lot of people that touch water resource management at the local level and at the state level and at the individual landowner level. So with that, the first part of this presentation is how is it that we're understanding what we've described as the risk of overuse and contamination? And I always like to start off by saying we're not California, we're not Texas, we're not in a crisis. And I've used the analogy that we're imagine ourselves in the urgency room rather than the emergency room. And in the urgency room, you get a little bit more time to analyze the situation. You do a little bit of triage, try to figure out where to focus your resources. And really, that's what I'm going to talk about is sort of how we've been approaching this over the last couple of years. There's been a lot that's been going on, and basically we're going to update you on what that work has been. So we start off with this basic graph of our water use, and this is showing our groundwater use over time Basically, what you take away from this is that on average, we're using about 3 billion gallons more water each year, on average. It fluctuates. You can see that in the graph, that some years more, some years less. Those of you that are into gardening or into agricultural production, you know that 2010 was a pretty wet year. You didn't have to water your garden very much, and we certainly didn't use nearly as much on your lawns or in our agricultural production. So our water use was pretty low. So it was a really great moisture year. But other years, we see that we don't get the rain necessarily as much and as when we need it, and we use more groundwater. Well, this is how we use the water in the state of Minnesota. Again, this is a statewide perspective of water use. You can see here that a little over half of the water, groundwater that we use, is for our municipal water supply systems. These are, the cities that pump water out of the ground, distribute it to homes, also to businesses. So this is not just domestic. It's not household use. But some of that water, a considerable amount, actually gets used for outside irrigation. But this is how it gets reported as the water supply systems. The next largest fraction is the 34% slice of the pie. And this, I should say, this is a five-year average. So any one year, this can vary a little bit. But it's helpful to sort of look at this over a period of time. Irrigation accounts for 34%, roughly 88 billion gallons of water a year. We use very little for power generation. Most of our water-related power generation is through river flow, turbines on rivers. We have some industrial processing. This category of use has been flat over time, and in fact a little bit declining. Even though we've seen some industrial expansion, industrial water use, there are a lot of incentives to be fairly efficient because of the cost of dealing with that water and processing water, etc. And then the other category is just a whole host of things that don't fit in those two big categories, and this would be things like snowmaking for ski resorts. It can be a whole variety of smaller subcategories of water use. Some of the other trends that we see is that agricultural irrigation is on a steady upward increase. Now, we're not in Nebraska. We're only about 3% of the agricultural land in the state is irrigated. 97% is not. But it is on a steady upward increase. And what we've been seeing at the DNR is the applications for water use permits also picking up in the last couple of years. 2 years ago, we came to the legislature with some ideas about how to better fund some of the work that we needed to do. And in the last 2 years, we've seen an unprecedented number of new applications for appropriation permits coming into the DNR. If you look at that period from 2008 through 2012, that was even a high number relative to what we saw in the decade before that. We used to get about 50 of these permits a year. So for a while, we were picking up to 100 and 200. Now, in the last couple of years, we've seen application numbers in the 500 to 600 range. Now, some of this is our own doing because we made a concerted effort to identify where there was water use and wells that looked like they were pumping water that would require a permit, but we did not have a record of a permit. And we sent letters and contacted those folks, and we've received about 100 applications as a part of that compliance effort. And this is one of the things a couple years ago that we were criticized for, that we had not been pursuing these non-compliant users. And so we've been doing that, and it's obviously increased our workload a little bit. The other thing you can see on this graph is that not all these appropriation permits are for agricultural irrigation, but the black bars do indicate that it's the large majority. This is where the most growth is taking place for appropriation permits in the state. The other thing I'll talk a little bit about today, but it's not DNR's expertise, but it's something we collaborate with our other executive branch agencies on, is understanding the contamination risk around groundwater. This is a map that the PCA recently produced that shows the chloride detection in groundwater. And it's getting to the point that we're detecting it more and more commonly, something that it can, could ultimately become a common detection, that it shows up that much. It's a little hard to see on this map, but there are some shaded areas there that are indicated as sand and gravel aquifers. These are sands and gravels that are really more exposed at the surface. They're more vulnerable to contamination, and they're more vulnerable to whether it be nitrates or in this case, chlorides migrating down into the aquifers just because there's not much there to protect them. We also know a little bit about nitrates in the state of Minnesota. We know that it shows up in some parts of the state more than others, and we know that it's showing up at levels that exceed the safe drinking water standards. This is a significant concern for the Department of Agriculture, and they're working on, and I'm sure you guys will hear about, the Nitrogen Fertilizer Management Plan, as well as for the Department of Health and how we deal with and protect our drinking water supplies. There are many municipalities, several I should say, that have had to implement water treatment systems to deal with high nitrates in their groundwater or seek alternative sources to find high quality water. We also know that in parts of the state we're seeing declines in the water levels in our aquifers. This is a graph from the West Metro out in Orono by Lake Minnetonka. This is our longest running period of record, the longest data set that we have, so it's valuable to illustrate a few things. One is that we have a steady downward trend. Number two, that it fluctuates every year because we see this seasonal pattern, these ups and downs. That's reflecting the fact that we use more water in the summer months than we do during the winter months. The other thing that I'd point out is that if you were to pick any five-year period on this graph and just sort of mentally block it, what you'd see is a very inconclusive picture. It doesn't appear to be a trend at all. But it's over a period of years where that trend emerges. So part of the challenge that we have, and I'll speak more about this, is whether or not these trends are sustainable. In groundwater, when you're pumping the groundwater, you're pulling it out of storage, what can happen over a period of time is a new equilibrium can establish. What we don't know is what's the projected future trend for this particular area right here. If increased water use continues to happen, we expect this water level to continue to decline. If that water use were to level off, might this rebound a little bit? Those are some of the difficulties that we have trying to figure out whether or not this is sustainable, and I'll talk more about that later. But
Mr. Mickle, you mentioned the location of this particular well was in the western suburbs, Orono, I think.
Orono, city of Orono, yeah.
So that, to me, conjures up houses and city development. Is this in an agricultural area?
This is not an agricultural area. Okay. No, this particular graph is not. So that's one location, but what do we know about the rest of the state? So this is a map of all the places where we had 20 years of groundwater water level data, which we feel is kind of a minimum to determine any kind of a trend. So let me explain. This is kind of a complicated map. The shading that you see on the map represents our groundwater provinces. So the Arrowhead, not the same when it comes to groundwater as the central province, that light green area, or for that matter, the southeast. These are all very different geologic settings. We have a very diverse state. We're very unique in that way across states. We're more complex than many other states in terms of our geology. There's not much for groundwater in the Arrowhead. There's a lot of aquifers in the southeastern third of the state, from the metro down through that south central province, the southeastern province. There are multiple layers of deep bedrock aquifers that we have available to us. And we have appropriations from many of those. The western province, those of you in southwestern Minnesota, this is not news. This is a groundwater challenged area of the state. There are not very extensive aquifers. They don't tend to have the highest water quality. Some are better than others. And you're familiar with the Lewis and Clark pipeline to bring water from the Missouri River Basin into this part of the state because it just is a lack of water and a real challenge. The western province as well, very similar. We've got the lake bed of Glacial Lake Agassiz, some deeper buried aquifers, but of unknown recharge characteristics. City of Moorhead, we've been working very closely with them on their water supply and how to meet those needs. And then the central province, which we tend to think of as the central sands, but it's very complicated because of the multiple times glaciers came and went and left this complex mix of deposits. What this map is showing you is what do we know about the water level trends? Blue dots on this map indicate that the water level trend, like the one I just showed you, was going upward over the last 20 years. Okay. The gray dots would indicate that the water level trend had been flat. And the yellow dots would indicate that the water level trend over the last 20 years was statistically significantly downward. This map does not tell us that those trends are due to pumping. It doesn't tell us why the trend is what it is. And I would point out that, for example, let's see if I have a little mouse that I can use to illustrate this. There it is. So I'm pointing to North Washington County. And you see that's characterized by all yellow. There are no real significant high-volume wells in that part of the county that we would attribute this downward trend to. And when we look at the precipitation data, we do in fact see that there are precipitation patterns and changes in that part of the county that suggest that precipitation is the driving factor for that downward trend. This map doesn't tell you the magnitude of trend. You know, the last graph I showed a pretty steep decline, but it could be a less steep decline. But it does give us a sense that we have a complicated picture. And the other thing I would hope you would see from this is that in an area like, for example, this is the Bonanza Valley. We'll talk about this. Okay, I've got yellows and I've got grays. So, and they're not too far apart from each other. So a lot of these issues can be very localized. And that's part of the challenge that we have. It's not a, oh, well, you know, here, we can put three wells in central Minnesota and know what's going on. Very localized. And the interaction with surface water is very localized.
And this data is all based on your monitoring well
system? This is based on our monitoring wells. You also see a large areas of the state where we just don't have any monitoring. This is 296 locations. That's where we had 20 years of data. Our network now has about 900 to 950 wells in it. Some of those we're trying to replace because they're just not producing good data. So 20 years from now, we'll have 900 sites with this kind of trend data. And filling in some of those gaps, but we still need more. There are many places where we still have gaps. All right, so I want to shift now to our responsibilities. I've alluded to some of these things.
Excuse me, a question from member Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meckel, you said that some of these wells are not producing good data. Can you explain that for me, please?
Representative Fabian, Mr. Chair, committee members, what happens is these wells, just like a private drinking water well, over time they can cease to function well. They lose contact with the aquifer. Sometimes it's just the screen at the bottom gets plugged up with material. And sometimes they can be refurbished. Sometimes they just can't. We seal them and we need to replace them. But what I mean by that is that when they lose contact with the aquifer, the water levels in the aquifer might be going up and down, and the well's not reflecting that. And we have ways of testing our wells to see if they're responding, if they're in contact with aquifer. That's part of work that we've done over the last 4 years to evaluate this network. It was a Clean Water Fund initiative to evaluate our statewide network and figure out what our needs were. So in terms of responsibilities, it's important for us to start with what do we understand about water rights in Minnesota? Some people are familiar with riparian water rights, which means if you have access to water, you have a certain amount of you can use it. Western water law is a prior appropriation sort of doctrine. Whoever had it first has the right to use it, and downstream users only get what's left over. In Minnesota, we're a riparian system, but our statutes say that you only have a right to use up to 1 million gallons. Through your riparian access. Anything beyond that is only granted as a privilege through a permit. That's what statutes say. The other part of this is that statutes say that your use of water has to be reasonable. You can't just be using it, you know, willy-nilly ways, whatever those might be. So by permit, it's 10,000 gallons a day if you're going to use more than that, or 1 million gallons per year. That's the threshold for triggering a permit. And the statutes also say that your ability to get that water is based on the availability, the sustainability, and also a priority system. So domestic consumption is higher priority than agricultural irrigation, or power generation is higher up there. Now, it doesn't affect groundwater very much. Those things are all higher priority than what are determined non-essential uses, such as lawn watering or car washes, those sorts of things. These are all spelled out in statute. So as I mentioned, we have permit thresholds of 1 million gallons per year. Just to give a reference, a family of four, kind of an average sort of range of use, might be around 100,000 gallons in a given year. So basically, private wells, by and large, are not going to require a permit. There are some exceptions to that. Some geothermal systems that are using groundwater use enough water to trigger permits, but for the most part, private homes, private wells don't require permits. So the kinds of activities, the kinds of uses that do are typically, as I said, municipal water systems, agricultural irrigation. And when I say agricultural irrigation, I'm including crop and non-crop, right? There's nursery irrigation, there's that sort of stuff, it's outdoor irrigation. Golf course, landscaping, ball fields, industrial uses, ethanol, mining, these are some of our categories of appropriations. And what the statutes say is that when the DNR is establishing how much is available, what you can pump, what your limit is, we must consider the sustainability of the resource. It says we need to take into consideration the current and the projected water levels. So you remember that graph where I showed the 60-year trend. What are the current water levels? How have they been changing over time? What is the projection going forward? We need to take into consideration things like water quality. Will pumping of an aquifer degrade water quality? There's sort of two simple ways that I can articulate how that happens. One, if I pull water out of storage, it's going to recharge from somewhere, either from some distance away to the side or from aquifers above it. And if that's contaminated, I'm potentially pulling contaminated water down deeper into aquifers. The other way this happens is, folks may be familiar with some of the plumes of contaminated aquifers that we have here in the metro. So if I put in a well next to a plume, I can cause water to move in a new direction, and now I'm pulling that contaminated water and potentially going to impact somebody else's wells. So we take those things into consideration to ensure that that doesn't happen when we issue permits. We also need to protect ecosystems. And there's a variety of statutes that talk about how we need to make sure that appropriations of groundwater don't impact the surface water features on the landscape. So you dewater your wetlands, you impact stream flow or lakes, etc. And then there's this future generation's ability to meet their needs. So some sense of we got to make sure that the water continues to be available well out into the future. Some of that's captured by the water level trend information.
Question from Representative Backer.
Thank you, Chair. My question, you talk about water quality. How clean does water have to be from the DNR point of view to discharge it back?
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair and members, I would defer that question to folks at PCA because discharge permits are required by the Pollution Control Agency, and they have a whole series of water quality standards that need to be met for a variety of different uses, and I don't know what all those are.
Okay.
Discharging?
Because we have a situation with the city of Morris in which the water that comes out of the well is meets all the standards for drinking, but when they discharge it back into Palm de Terre, it's cleaner than what they pull out of the aquifers, and they're having problems discharging it. So just for the record.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meckel, to that point then, where are the lines drawn between the analysis that DNR is doing? Because you've talked about water quality, water quantity. Where are the lines drawn there between your agency and other agencies to monitor those and in this case, enforce?
Mr. Meck.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, the Pollution Control Agency monitors water quality that has to do with anything not agricultural chemicals. The Department of Agriculture monitors for water quality dealing with agricultural chemicals. And when it comes to dealing with plumes, the Pollution Control Agency manages those permits, but we work very closely to make sure that the appropriations and plume management are in sync so that we're not in contradiction.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'll pass for now. Thanks. I'll talk to you offline. Thank you.
Well, I would just... Along that same line, has the 2012 legislation increased the DNR's looking into water quality? Or do you see your purpose today the same as it was 10 years ago in terms of looking at the water quality part of it?
Chairman Anderson, I'm not familiar with the water quality legislation aspect of in 2012. The changes in statute that I'm familiar with are in 2010, the sustainability language that came in. But water quality had always been there, is my recollection, that we have to consider water quality. But I'm not certain about the 2012 language that you might be referring to. I need to look into that.
Well, just my point was that the awareness certainly has been increased in the last couple of years about quality and quantity, and your meetings around the state have emphasized both aspects. Representative Hansen.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think a lot of the roles were defined back in 1989 with the Groundwater Protection Act, and having the Department of Ag having very specific roles relating to agricultural pesticides, quantity issues being with the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Health having the well code responsibilities, and then the PCA dealing with other contaminants. What I found interesting was the chloride data earlier. If we've tended to think of common detection as being a pesticide issue, but if chlorides are moving to common detection, that may be from road salt or other types of things, which brings in a different realm of stuff than we've been dealing with before. And that may be the PCA weighing in more than the Department of Ag if chlorides are a new contaminant of concern. So it might be good to, next time Ag comes up, to talk about the roles from the Groundwater Protection Act. I think where DNR comes in is with the appropriations and then the quantity that's there, but they also have surface water responsibilities to make sure that the fish and game are being maintained.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may be a question for Representative Hansen or Mr. Meckel. So when there's all these different agencies involved, and Mr. Meckel, you said you have 900 and some wells or whatever that number is, do the different agencies test out of the same wells? Do they have their own separate wells? Help me out.
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we do share wells. We collaborate on that. In some cases, we'll drill wells for the Department of Agriculture because we have a drilling rig. And each well is identified and located for a particular purpose. But in many cases, that purpose can be multi-purpose. Department of Ag is typically monitoring shallow aquifers and looking for nitrates. And sometimes that's really important and helps us in terms of water levels. But we're also looking at deeper aquifers for water levels. Similarly, PCA is typically looking more in the shallow, but sometimes deeper. And they tend to look in areas where there's more likely sources of contaminants as well. So some of those, you know, if it's if we're dealing with a plume, for example, plume management, the water level monitoring there isn't as valuable to us as it is maybe somewhere else. But we do absolutely share. And all of our data is going into two shared databases between all the agencies. So all of this stuff. And this is all recent, just in the last couple of years that we've moved to this system, where all of the water quality data and all the water quantity data are going in the same two systems across agencies.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Meckel, if you come in and say that DNR, that you're monitoring, say, roughly 900 wells, I'm just picking some numbers, and then MPCA comes in and tells us they're monitoring 800 wells, and Ag has got 600, whatever the numbers are, I don't care. How many of those wells are being counted multiple times? I mean, how many total wells do we have in the state of Minnesota for water quality and quantity measuring?
Mr. Meckel?
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, I don't know the total number off the top of my head. We did an exercise. We mapped all these, and we put them in a performance report for the Clean Water Fund that shows which ones and for what purposes. But that's something we could follow up in terms of the total number and then where are there some duplications, et cetera, or count where maybe it's being counted at. Multiple times, for example.
And I think along that same line, what are the numbers today of, I assume we're talking monitoring wells, and what is the hope or the goal of that when you get the whole system laid out, how many monitoring wells do you think would be sufficient to cover the state?
Chair and committee members, we've done some analysis based on this report that I talked about, this evaluation of our network, and projected a need for as many as 7,000 monitoring wells statewide. But we recognize that would take many years to construct. What we have done over the last couple of years, as I mentioned, talking about this being in the urgency room, right, where do you need to target your resources? My staff in the groundwater technical unit have looked at where do we have surface water resources and high amounts of water use. where do we have community water supplies? And then said, well, where do we have monitoring data to help us understand what's going on and where don't we? And we have a list right now of 500 locations where we have inadequate groundwater level data to address the needs for community water supplies, their long-term water supply planning, or impacts to surface water resources, or our ability to really understand cumulative use in intensively used areas. So that's the sort of short-term what we're really focused on.
Continue on.
Thank you. Just about 2 years ago now, a new law was passed. The way it used to work was that if you wanted a new well, if you were an irrigator, you'll say you're an irrigator, you want a new well, you'd call up your well driller, they'd notify the Department of Health, hey, I'm going to drill this well, file an application, a notification, I should say. They'd drill the well, they'd record the information on all the material they went through, what the water levels were, what the pump, they'd do a little pump test to see how the well performed to make sure it yields water. And they'd file that information. Then that well owner would come to the DNR sometime later and request an appropriation permit. What we were finding is that in places where there were already a lot of existing uses or locations where a well might be real close to a calcareous fen or some trout streams, that in fact we wouldn't be able to issue them a permit for the amount of water that they were requesting. And here they just spent $30,000 or $60,000 to drill a well that they can no longer use. So we worked with the legislature 2 years ago to pass this law that says, all right, if you're going to drill a well, go get an assessment from the DNR. So what we're required to do is to determine whether that anticipated appropriation request is likely to meet the applicable requirements in statute. There's no fee for this. It's just an application. And typically, we're able to turn these around within 3 to 5 days. When we get into some fairly complex settings, we try to do a little bit more analysis if we have data available. We've done over 600 of these in the last year and a half. And of those, we've sent letters to everybody. And of those, we've sent about 24 letters that, paraphrasing, essentially have said, you're in a location that is complicated. There are these kinds of issues around you, potentially well interference or a community water supply or a calcareous fen or a trout stream, and we don't think it's likely you could get a permit for the amount of water you're looking for. Let's have a conversation and see what we can figure out. And in some cases, we've been able to direct those applicants before they made that investment to drill to a deeper aquifer, because we might have some knowledge in that area that that's an option that is more sustainable. Dakota County is one example of that. In other cases, we've saved people from making those investments. They've just chosen this is not a viable situation for them. So in some cases, we don't ever know what they've decided. We've sent them a letter, and we haven't heard anything. They got the letter, and we never got an application. So, but we think this is providing a valuable service to people.
Mr. Meckel, I appreciate this new timeline, but there were a few people caught kind of in between, in the flux between the old method and your new method. And there was a lot of frustration by somebody who had already dug the well, maybe even bought the center pivot, and was kind of in limbo with moving forward. How have those been addressed?
Chair Anderson and committee members, you're absolutely right. There were, and we're still trying to work through a couple of situations where individuals prior to this law passing had gone about in the way they always had and had installed these wells, made these investments. And prior to this, you know, when we get the application, we'd look at it and we'd, you know, this is a complicated situation. We're going to need to work through some aquifer tests, et cetera. And in some of those cases, the results came back, and by statute, we don't believe we can issue a permit for the amount of water. So we're working with them. In some cases, we're working out situations, well, maybe if you, you know, and they say, well, what if I did this and I could operate for a day and then I'm off for 3 days and I operate for a day? You know, what if I put in some monitoring, you know, and we can, and we've been looking at cell phone technology so that, you know, we can use technology to give us good information. We're working through a handful of those kinds of situations. But you're absolutely right. And that's why this law was so valuable, is that people at least now have the information going into it to help make that decision. But in some cases, we still have to say no to the amount they want. Usually we can find something less than the total amount of water they're looking for. But in some cases, even then, we can't. So if try to get us back into our time. We've been taking some questions along the way, which has been great. I'll try to keep it moving here. Essentially, what this graphic illustrates is things that we need to take into consideration in a permit. So you get a high-volume well. When you pump that well, you create these cones of depression, right? So what we're trying to understand is the cone of depression and what does it affect? In this case, it's showing that it's affecting a domestic well. We can't allow that to happen, and so the only way we can issue a permit here is if somehow this domestic well situation gets resolved. So maybe they drill a deeper well and it takes care of the problem. Or in this case, we're showing a wetland being impacted, and we can't allow that to happen. So, you know, what do you do? Can you move the high volume well farther away so you can, you know, so the cone doesn't reach it, that sort of thing? And really, and then the other thing is, when we pump groundwater, as this graphic illustrates, and this is the not intuitive part, this is the very difficult thing to see when you're looking at the landscape, is that, and you look at the bottom here, showing a well on the right-hand side of the graphic, pumping water. But it's actually affecting the lake on the right side, but it's also affecting the stream that's on the other side of what would be a watershed divide. Groundwater does not respect surface water boundaries. Surface water, it flows downhill. It's always going to respect that unless we pump it somewhere. But groundwater does not. There's nothing to divide that. And so when we're looking at appropriations, we have to consider how this is spreading out, these cones of depression. And then when we look at the way that we're developing our groundwater resources, what you see with all these dots, and this is just irrigation permits, is essentially multiple cones of depression in relation to one another. So it's not just one, but many, right? And then we throw in our community water supplies on this. And so how do these cones of depression, these uses of groundwater, interact with each other and with surface waters? That's Representative the challenge that we have.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Meckel. I'd like to go back to the slide with the illustrated cone of depression. And if the high pumping well is draining as represented, is there an obligation for the high pumping well operator to make sure that domestic well is dug deeper to have access to water? Do they have an obligation to make well the domestic well?
Mr. Meckel?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, they do have an obligation, and the obligation depends on whether it's known before the permit is issued or after a permit has been issued and that problem develops over time. So, for example, this might not happen in the first 5 years that somebody's operating, and in our analysis of that permit, we didn't anticipate it to happen. So we look at all domestic wells. That's part of the application. You have to notify where are the domestic wells around you so that we can evaluate what the potential impact would be. But sometimes this would develop over time as a result of multiple users in the area, and we wouldn't have known it ahead of time. But if it's known ahead of time, if we anticipate that this was going to happen, what we would say is that we can't issue a permit because of anticipated well interference, and we're fairly confident in that. Then what they would do is have to work it out, right? Work it out with the neighbor. Hey, okay, well, I can drill you a new well deeper. Are you amenable? And they work that out, and they let us know, hey, we've worked it out, and this is the okay, and then we can issue the permit if they're able to do that. If they can't work it out, then we're not going to issue the permit until something gets resolved. And it might simply be, well, okay, I don't pump as, you know, I only pump once a week, or, you know, we can figure out some things like that. But we don't run into this too often. But it does happen.
Representative Johnson.
And then in the case, Mr. Chair and Mr. Meckel, if it happens after the permit, can you describe the process to make sure that the domestic well is made whole?
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, the way the process works, I might generalize this a little bit, is if you were the domestic homeowner and you experienced an out-of-water situation, you don't have water. It might be your pump. But in any case, you're probably calling a well driller saying, hey, I'm out of water. Can you come out and take a look at this? They're going to conduct an evaluation and try to determine, did your well go bad? Is it lost contact with the aquifer like I was talking about with monitoring wells? Screen plugged. Maybe they can clean it, take care of it. Is the pump bad? Is the pump just higher than where the water levels are? Can they just lower the pump? But in some cases, It's none of those things, and the only resolution is to replace the well. In any case, the homeowner has the ability to contact us, fill out a well interference complaint, have their well driller certify the information of what they've determined, and then we investigate and determine whether or not we think that, okay, is there a nearby high-volume well, and is that well likely to be contributing based on the information that's available to us in that situation? And if it is, they're not able to pump that high-volume well until it gets resolved, until we know there's an agreement to resolve that well interference complaint. These things get very complicated, and I think Al Anderson and some of the other folks that will testify, this has been a challenge for us because it's getting more and more complicated with more and more users impacting and their cumulative impacts.
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. One other question related to that is that so it's really between the two parties, the high-volume user and the domestic well user, to work out the agreement. Is that correct?
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, it is, although frequently we're finding out it's more than just one part or two parties. We're finding out it's multiple parties. That adds to the difficulty. You got neighbors involved, multiple neighbors. We do technical work, and we get caught in the middle. People want their permits. They want to move on, but we got this well interference, and it's a very challenging situation. Some of the most difficult issues that we deal with.
Well, one more, Mr. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more question, I promise. I'm just curious on the irrigation permits. Are those all ag irrigation permits, or are there commercial?
Mr. Meckel?
Chair and Representative Johnson, the irrigation permits are non-crop and major crop irrigation. So it includes landscape, you know, nursery irrigation, that sort of thing.
Good questions, good comments. Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was interested, how many, have we had any situations where we've had to deal with wetland mitigation relative to a wetland being basically drained? And if we have, I'd be very interested in the history on that. And if we haven't, do you predict that's going to happen in the future?
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I've missed the last name, I'm sorry. We do have situations in the past where we've anticipated as part of our analysis that a wetland would be impacted or a fence would be impacted. And we've worked through the scenarios, doing some research in the area, monitoring activities to see what was happening. And as a result of that research, we've been able to modify some permits. And there's a couple of good examples in southwestern Minnesota of that sort of a scenario. We're working on a couple of applications right now where there are some surface water bodies and some appropriations very nearby in some very sandy soils, and the monitoring that was done as part of the evaluation showed when we monitored the wetland and we saw what was going on in the pumping, we saw the wetland going down every time the irrigator turned on in that situation. And so we've been trying to work with the applicant on options, is, you know, farther away. Sometimes you're limited in that way, but we do have some of those, and we anticipate to have more of that as we see more and more use. There's a lot of infilling going on in small pockets and smaller parcels, but overall an increase.
Go,
so I'm getting close to the end of the slides.
Yeah.
As I mentioned, we've been doing quite a bit over the last couple of years to try to get a better handle on this, and I talked about being in the urgency room. So the DNR put together this draft strategic plan that I think we've distributed around, and it's up on our website, and we got public input on it, and it's been out for just about a year and a half now. And we identified sort of seven things that we feel that are within our responsibilities based on statute of what we can do to make sure groundwater use is sustainable. They're presented here. I'll just quickly go through them. Heighten the priority. You know, for a long time, groundwater was an afterthought in Minnesota. We didn't think much about it. It's land of 10,000 lakes, for crying out loud. We got all these rivers. You know, why do we need to worry about this? Well, our monitoring data indicates we do need to be paying attention and maybe have some concerns in certain areas. And we need to make sure people understand that. Groundwater is 75% of our drinking water supply in this state. It's hugely important to our economy, and it's hugely important to our resources. So it is worth paying attention to. And as I've illustrated in a couple of different times, we do really need to enhance the information that we have available. We have a complex state, complex geology, complex set of uses, And if we're going to manage our water sustainably, we need good data to do that. We are doing our part to try to improve the way we manage permits. The way this used to work is you got an appropriation permit from us, and as long as you reported your water use and paid your fees, we generally never had a reason to go back and revisit any of these things. And they've been issued for 40 or 50 years, some of them. But as more and more uses get concentrated in a particular area, we do have a need, according to statute, to go back and make sure that we're allocating that water in a way that is not only sustainable, but allocating among the various users and by priority. So we're working on mechanisms to make sure that we can do that, follow the statutes and rules. I talked about improving our compliance efforts. So we've targeted areas where we've identified noncompliance. We still have more work to do, but we focused on areas where we could, where we saw a high concentration of noncompliance. We're working on our communication and education. We're improving our website so that all of this data that I mentioned that's in these databases is going to be more readily available and accessible to our local units of government, to community water suppliers, to cooperators, and to the public. And where I'm going to go next for the rest of this PowerPoint is how we're trying to effectively address these challenges in areas of high use. This is sort of the triage, if you will, in the urgency room. But the last bullet I have up here is, no matter what, whatever we're talking about here, promoting conservation and wise use just makes sense. The less we pull out of the ground, the less risk we are at of overusing, and the less risk we have of moving contamination deeper or horizontally into our aquifers. We just use less, we have less problems. So this is what a monitoring installation looks like for us. You see that large well in the middle there. You can see there's some instrumentation that's been pulled up, and we're downloading the water level data recorder. You see these three pipes around it. That's to protect it from somebody careening into it with a snowmobile, or depending on how close this is to a roadway, a car, or a tractor, or whatever it might be. It's up high so that it's not going to get buried. It's not a safety issue. But this is what these sort of things look like. This is down on the Vermilion River in Dakota County.
Mr. Meckel,
yes, sir.
I would assume these are on private property. Do the landowners say okay, give approval to put these wells in, or how do you work with that?
Mr. Chair, our wells are located on all kinds of situations. We inherited some of these wells from old municipal wells, and they've given us access. Sometimes it's on private property. We have an agreement. Some of these are on state land, county land, park land. Wherever we can get somebody to cooperate with us, we will work it out to do that if we have a need in that area.
And is a typical well 4-inch, 6-inch casing, is it just to pretty much monitor the level of the water underneath, down below?
Mr. Chair, yeah, typically our monitoring wells are a 4-inch casing. Not always. Like I said, sometimes we've got somebody's old production well. They're not using it anymore. But most of our installations are a 4-inch well casing, and they're just to monitor water level in a designated aquifer. You have multiple aquifers sometimes beneath each other, and in those cases we install what we call a nest. So we'll install a well in the first aquifer, and then next door we'll put one in the next aquifer below, and then in the next aquifer. In some cases we've got four of these wells in one spot so that we're monitoring how these aquifers interact with each other, and that's the case on this one in the Vermilion River. And we also have a stream gauge nearby, so what we have is water in the river, water in the aquifers at multiple levels, how they're changing and interacting with each other over time.
Okay.
This map just illustrates, as I said, this happens to be in the Bonanza Valley, and you can see here we've got multiple irrigation permits. So imagine cones of depression under each one of these, potentially interacting with each other. You've got a municipal water supply here in the community. So you've got a wellhead protection area somewhere in the area to protect their water supply from contamination and also amount of water. We've got surface water features shown here in this photograph. Those are the sort of things that we need to take into consideration. And if we don't have monitoring data or aquifer characteristics in that area, we'll use the best that we have, try to estimate, try to model, and figure out what's going on. But ultimately, the real proof is in the pudding, right? It's what's actually happening.
Nice looking crops. Nice looking crops.
Yeah. They're green. So another thing that we've done is to try to look at this from multiple angles. And what this map is illustrating is some analysis that we did, and we looked at small catchments. About 300,000 of these surface water catchments that we've got mapped around the state, catchment being a place that's where water's flowing to a designated point. And we looked at how much water was being pumped out of that catchment or upstream catchments, and we have estimates of the amount of water that's flowing through that catchment because we have stream gauges around the state and we can do models and we use statistical analyses to say, well, here's how much water's coming through the system. And we compare how much water's being pumped and appropriated versus how much is coming through the system. We consider whether or not that appropriation is a consumptive use or a non-consumptive use. So a non-consumptive use, you know, for example, a municipal system, a lot of that water gets used, it gets treated, you know, comes to our homes, goes through a waste treatment facility and gets discharged, so it gets a factor of some non-consumptive uses. Or, for example, some of our hatchery appropriations, they don't consume the water, just moving through the system. And what we did is we said, what is the amount of water relative used versus the amount available there? And we're calling that a mean use index. And what I'm showing you on this map is the places where we're using 5%, more than 10%, or more than 20% of the mean water available in that whole watershed. Okay. And it kind of gives you this sense of, like I said, that in the urgency room, right? There are certain areas of the state where it seems like we're using more of the available water than others. So if I look at this map here and I point out, this is the Straight River area. If you look at that, we got a lot of yellow, a lot of orange, and a lot of red. We're focusing our energy, we're focusing our monitoring, we're intensifying our analysis in that area because that's an area that might be at risk of an unsustainable use of groundwater. The black lines here indicate our groundwater management areas. We chose to try to pilot the use of this approach in these three areas of the state. The one in the middle, if I can get the mouse back on here, this is our Bonanza Valley groundwater management area right here, and here's our North and East Metro groundwater management area. I'll point out some other areas that we've identified where there are potential concerns and issues. We've got a lot of effort going on in Dakota County, indicated by the vermilion tag on there. I keep losing the mouse here. I'm trying to point these things out. We've got the Little Rock Creek watershed in central Minnesota here. We've got Cold Spring Brewery. We've got some of these other places here where there's high intensity concentration of use that we're trying to get a better handle on whether or not it meets statutory obligations. And in none of these situations have we said absolutely it is or it isn't, but we're working our way through it. And I'm going to then talk about the groundwater management areas. Are there questions on this map? Because it's
got a question from Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meckel, I represent Parker's Prairie, and Parker's Prairie isn't exactly a very large town, couple thousand people. Do you have an idea of exactly what the issue is over there?
Mr. Meckel?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I believe that there's a lot of agricultural irrigation in the area, but I don't have specific knowledge about the various use categories in that specific geography. We could follow up if that's something you're interested in.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Meckel, I just would follow up with a question. And when you talk about stream flows and surface water bodies drying up, how do you account for the natural drying process through the summer? If it's a hot, dry summer, in my area there are no irrigation wells where I live, but yet potholes dry up, streams dry up naturally. So how do you account for that in terms of that cause and then factor in irrigation, for example?
Mr. Chair and committee, so for streams, ideally we'd have a stream gauge and a period of record that said here's what the flows are, and you know, as you said, they vary, right? One year it could be really wet, yep. Another year dry. But what you establish are some means, some regular patterns that show up. Like August is typically a low flow time of year. May and June typically are a high flow time of year. Similar thing happens in our lakes and wetlands. We typically peak water levels in May, June, and then they tend to decline pretty steadily from there on. So the best scenario is that we have information about that surface water, whether it's a water level trend in the lake or, you know, we've gauged about 1,000 lakes in the state that we monitor water levels through a volunteer network or with many of our stream gauges. And what we determine is whether or not we've exceeded some sort of some percentage of the flow in the system that's going to be stressful to the ecology, or if we're exacerbating the fluctuation of lake levels beyond what statute provides. In statute, there's a surface water provision that says appropriations can only be up to the volume of 1/2 acre foot of the surface water. So let me put it this way. For every acre of water, you can have 1/2 acre, so 6 inches for every acre. That's the volume that we can allow to be appropriated through surface water appropriations.
And you brought up or mentioned Cold Spring, the brewery up there. It's been around for a long, long time. What's the situation there? Have you worked something out in terms of stream flow up in that area?
Chairman Anderson and committee members, we have been working closely with the brewery and the community. I've not personally been involved in those conversations, but I know that we've got a plan. The brewery is working on a plan to find an alternative water source. We've recently been installing additional monitoring information to help us better understand the whole area and what some of the options are and how things will interact in terms of groundwater and surface water relationships. But I don't know the details of where the details of the plan that the folks have worked out.
Well, when I hear people saying the brewery's been there for 100 years and the stream is still flowing, so the question's asked, is there a problem there, or what are we looking for there?
Chairman Anderson and committee members, what's happening is that while the brewery's been there for a long time, the amount of water that they're requesting and using has changed over time, and they were issued a temporary permit a few years ago. I don't recall the specific date. And what we said is that, you know, this is not going to be a sustainable amount of water, and you need to find an alternative source. And, we've been working through a process for a number of years to try to do that. The area is complicated because you've got municipal supplies. There's concerns about high nitrates, and if the city were to use more water, it might impact the water quality. So those are the things that Department of Health and Department of Ag and us and those folks are trying to work through and understanding them.
Okay, Representative Backer.
Thank you, Chair. You said that's not sustainable. Who's determined that that's not sustainable? Because we've never been in a situation that it ever has ran out. So who's making that definition?
Mr. Mickle.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the statutes define what sustainable is, and it relates to this water levels, water quality, impacts to surface waters. So in some of these cases, what we've determined is that so much water has been diverted away from the stream that it's impacted that stream and it's not functioning the way that it could or should, and it's threatened or it's in jeopardy or it won't support the trout species, for example. In the situation of Cold Spring Brew, we've determined that a significant amount of the water has been diverted away from the stream and it's impacting that stream and its ability to persist as a trout stream. So we make that determination based on what statutes define.
That reminds me of a question. You mentioned streams and trout streams. Again, there's some discussion of how some of these streams got labeled. Back up in my area, there's a mud creek that's a trout stream. Is there any movement to look at that again and look at the how some of those streams are classified?
Yeah, Chairman Anderson and committee members, yes, our section of fisheries has been reviewing information that they have on all the trout streams to see if there are streams that in fact don't meet the criteria of being a designated trout stream. They're working through that process now. The process just generally is that if there's a change in a designation, either to propose one or to or undesignate it, we go through, pull the data, the information, fill out a information sheet, and there's a 90-day public notification and comment period. All riparian landowners get notified, public notice, opportunity for comment, etc. And then ultimately DNR makes the decision about whether or not to proceed with whatever that change is. It could be an addition or a deletion based on what information we have available. And our section of fisheries is working through a process right now of revisiting all of the streams that are designated and determining which ones meet those kinds of criteria, and there'll be a public process.
Okay.
Going forward.
Okay, good. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Mickle, I have a question about the East Metro area and wondering if you've had monitoring data for many decades, what the impact of the legislative action to ban once through cooling for buildings had when that was made about 20 years ago. Can you did that make a difference in terms of water levels, or maybe just some explanation of what that was?
Mr. Meckel.
Representative Anderson, Representative Hansen, and members, on that statewide map that I showed you with the 296 sites, there were a few blue dots right in the core of the Twin Cities, and I usually point that out, and I forgot to do that, so thank you for bringing that up. Our belief is that, in fact, that is the result of the change, that we've seen an upward trend, the rebound, once the once-through cooling was banned by the legislature. The aquifers right underneath Minneapolis and St. Paul have begun to rebound from where they had been for a number of years. Not necessarily where they were pre-development, but they definitely have been responding to that change. I already pointed these groundwater management areas out on the previous map, but so here they are. So just a few slides on what's going on. So I've talked about the data and the analysis and our responsibilities and what we're understanding, and that we've got these concentrations of use in these groundwater management areas and some concerns, right? So a year ago in January, we initiated three groundwater management area planning projects. We invited every permitted stakeholder from that geography and all locally elected officials to come to a meeting to learn about what we were planning to do. We formed project advisory teams with representatives across the wide spectrum of users, permittees, as well as local and state government and other interested parties to help inform us. And we've been meeting almost monthly since January of 2014. We try to avoid bad months for particular interest groups, agriculture, there's certain months that just don't work. And what we've done is in those areas, we've taken all the data that we've had and we've shared the data. We've shown them these water level trends. We've had the Department of Ag talk about what do we know about water quality in this area in terms of nitrates or pesticides. PCA has talked about what do we know about other contaminants in these geographies. We've shared all this information. We've talked about it. We've laid out what the statutes say our responsibilities are, and we've framed these statutes simply as a goal to manage the water sustainably and a set of objectives that we think help us to know whether or not we're doing that. We've reviewed those objectives and those goals with the project advisory teams. We identified a bunch of actions that we think will help us achieve those objectives and goals. We've prepared these as a draft plan. We just recently have begun sharing these draft plans now with our advisory teams, and we've been getting feedback from the advisory teams about those sets of actions. And I will just highlight sort of the things you could see in these. What we say is, for example, in the Bonanza Valley, we're going to improve the information by adding 14 new groundwater wells in these areas where we have some gaps. We're going to add 6 stream flow monitoring stations through the North Fork of the Crow and maybe its tributaries. Don't quote me on that because I don't know if that's the exact number, but this is what these plans say, right? So stuff like this. We also say that we are going to go back and review all the permits that we've issued there and make sure that they are, in fact, sustainable. Doesn't mean they're going to change, but we are going to go back and review them all in light of the information that we have and make sure that we are sustainably using the water. And if we need to, we'll make amendments. We're going to involve the stakeholders all the way through on this process. We've committed to hold 2 ongoing meetings of a group from these geographies every year for the next 5 years to check in on how we're implementing the plan. And I want to emphasize, this is a plan for what the DNR is going to do. We're not planning for anybody else. We're only planning for what we can control and what we can do. However, things that we say we want to do do involve others, and they do invite collaboration and partnership. So how can we work with the local unit of government on some of these things? We use soil and water conservation districts to help us with monitoring, for example. So what this plan will lay out is what some of the nature of those relationships will be. We talk about how can we support conservation efforts. So there's things we can do in the agricultural sector to reduce the amount of water that we use. Maybe it's through scheduling. There's soil and water conservation districts that are developing expertise, working with the Department of Ag, University Extension. How do we give these folks the best available information to use the water most efficiently? Smartphone apps, this kind of stuff, better climate information, all those sorts of things. We're improving communication. We've got a website. We're working on that. We're working on coordination with other units of government. And the other executive branch agencies, Department of Ag, Department of Health, PCA, are also looking at these geographies and saying, given our statutory responsibilities, what actions will we take in the Bonanza Valley over the next 5 years to support the DNR and this area in sustainable water use? So we talked about monitoring for water quality issues. So what sort of water quality network expansion needs to happen? Or maybe we just continue with what we've got. Those sorts of things. So those agencies are working on what their actions will be, and those will be included as an addendum to these plans. I mentioned where we're at. We've got draft plans. We're reviewing those with our advisory teams now. Then we're going to go out for broader public input. All permittees, locally elected, everybody will be invited to come and learn about what's in these plans, ask questions about these plans, and have a period of time to comment on these plans, tell us if we've missed the mark or if we need to better clarify or explain things. And our goal is that we will have gone through that process and have three plans that our commissioner can sign and say, this is what I'm committing my agency to do for the next 5 years in this geography and how we will go about doing it.
Question from Representative Lewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back to that term trout streams and simply ask, are we talking about pre-European trout streams that existed based on Mother Nature? Are we including trout streams and lakes that have trout in them now because we've relocated fish? And that doesn't just apply to trout, obviously. And why, you know, we move muskies around, we move a lot of fish around, sometimes trying to outsmart Mother Nature. But I'm very sensitive to who designates them, and can we tell the difference between a pre-European trout stream that was here before we drilled any wells and something that we hear thrown around as a label? So can you elaborate on that, sir?
Mr. Meckel.
Chairman Anderson, Representative Lewin. I will a little bit. I would also defer that our section of fisheries might be able to give you a more expanded explanation. The way designation works is that the stream needs to meet certain water quality characteristics. One of the things that distinguishes, one of the biggest things that distinguishes the trout stream from streams that don't support trout is the temperature profile. Streams that have a high inflow of groundwater remain colder during the summer, but also warmer in the winter. Those are two really key characteristics for trout to survive. And what we know about trout is that they'll move during the spring and the fall when all the streams are suitable for their, you know, during the summer months, they're only going to hang out in the coldest water. I don't know what kind of data we have going back to our settlement, but I know that the designated trout streams that we have and the way we manage them is based on, do they meet the characteristics that they support a trout, would support a trout population. And many of these streams have been designated or managed as trout streams for 50, 60 or more years. But our folks in fisheries might want to elaborate a little bit more on some of the specifics and what they do or don't know about a particular stream, but that's just a general picture of what's the difference.
Representative Lewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just as a follow-up, you're talking about 40, 50 years, and this wasn't a stream. This was a small lake that was identified as with those characteristics. But Mother Nature had not determined that it was going to work, so we went ahead and planted trout in there for a number of years, and that, guess what, that lake went over time right back to sunfish, northerns, and so I think we need to make sure, and again, this is probably not your area of expertise, but we need to make sure that we defer to Mother Nature here on some of these things, because even if you've got the right water temperature and other things that we've determined, you want to be awful careful about sticking species into a place where Mother Nature did not originally put them and sustain them, and then basing a whole lot of things that we all have to deal with on that. And again, not your area of expertise, but I've seen a number of times when we've created things and then force the regulations around them, and they were not here in pre-European days, and Mother Nature made that determination. So, thank you, sir.
Point well said. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'll try to set the stage here so I get my point across as well. And, you know, we have a very unique opportunity here. No question about it. Let's first visit. We had a gentleman that was born in Iowa and then studied and was affiliated with the University of Minnesota. It was Norman E. Borlaug. And Norman E. Borlaug, he was the founder, the creator, the father of the Green Revolution. And he is credited as saving more lives than anybody else in the history of mankind. That's pretty powerful. And he has received a number of honors and awards. And he ranks right up there with five individuals that received those same honors that were still living, right up there with Martin Luther King Jr., Nelson Mandela, Mother Teresa, Norman E. Borlaug, right? We have an opportunity here to where through research and investing into the next generation, if you will, of crop production, we have the opportunity to not only help end world hunger, but safeguard our natural resources through biotechnology. And I listened to a gentleman speak. He was one of the co-founders of Greenpeace, and he left Greenpeace. He's the ex-president of Greenpeace, Dr. Patrick Moore. And the reason he left Greenpeace is because their anti-stance against biotechnology, and in particular, the golden rice, where you can actually take vitamins and beta-carotene and breed them into rice, and it helps end world hunger, night blindness in children or the adults, etc. We have the opportunity to do this. And what I would like to do is maybe we could consider, Mr. Chairman, to bring other individuals in here to talk about the opportunities that we have through seed production and everything else to where we can actually increase the yields and use less water. So we can address a lot of this through biotechnology as well. And like when I said this, I do not want to pit one segment of agriculture against another. That is not the goal here, because I want it all. I want it all, right? But I think we have a wonderful opportunity here to better understand what we have available to where through agriculture, through research, through biotechnology, to where we can address this as well. All the great work that you're doing and all the great work that everybody else is doing as well. But we have the opportunity to address this, like I said, in other ways. And again, help end world hunger and safeguard our natural resources. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it.
Very, very good point. Yeah, along those same lines, comes to mind there are corn hybrids now being produced. Aquamax comes to mind. I don't know who has that type of corn, but it uses less water, more efficiently. And yes, that's a good approach to looking at this situation. Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. My question has to do with an event I went to last night that talked about the Minnesota River and raised concerns about, started the story actually talking about Lake Pepin and how Lake Pepin is filling up with sediment at a faster rate in the last so many years than it had in thousands of years before. It's a natural thing for sediments to flow into Lake Pepin, but at a faster rate is unusual. And he laid out the story that the main cause of this is really increased water flow through the Minnesota River Valley. And he identified three causes of this. And one is the heavier rains that we've been experiencing causing the flood events that have been happening. A second was increased drainage on croplands, and the third was row crops that hold water later in the season rather than early in the season. So we have this issue with and I have to say, the science that he talked about was truly amazing. To borrow Representative Hamilton's word, it was awesome. They can measure exactly where the sediments are coming from, whether it's the top of a bluff or down below or in the banks or whatever. And so they can really tell a thorough story about what's happening to the water. At the end of the presentation, a geologist asked the question, is this affecting groundwater in that area? And, you know, the fact that the water is just rushing off, and what can we do about it? What can we apply to remedy this problem?
Mr. Meckler, you want to challenge, take on that one?
Yeah.
I'll tell you, excuse me, Mr. Chairman and committee members, I was there as well, and I agree with your overall assessment. It was a very compelling story. And what's important, I would add, is that the Minnesota River Valley is not the same as the Mississippi River Valley, and everything that he described is unique to the Minnesota River Valley. It's a very unique situation. And, in fact, too much water, and particularly too much during the spring, is really what's driving this mm-hmm. sediment issue, as you pointed to. But it's an interesting question as to whether or not groundwater recharge, I'll reframe your question
yes,
this way.
Sure.
Has groundwater recharge changed substantially in the Minnesota River Valley as a result of those same things that you described? And I'm not aware of anybody that's specifically trying to address that question with any sort of targeted research and monitoring effort. Now, we have monitoring wells, but to focus on that question would take, I think, a very specific sort of research project, if you will, and I'm not aware of anybody doing that work. The soils are different, so who knows? You know, but certainly it's something that might be going on, you know, this, as I indicated, southwestern Minnesota, the Minnesota River Valley in general, particularly the southern part of it, and the tributaries that flow from the south into the Minnesota River Valley, are not very groundwater-rich areas to begin with. And they're pretty confined aquifers, you know, below a lot of clay, and recharge is pretty slow. But to what effect recharge has changed, we don't know.
And then getting into a discussion of drainage is a whole new topic for another yeah. another day, and we need to move along here. Any other follow-ups, Representative Bly? No? Representative Johnson. Okay.
So this is my last slide.
Okay.
I've emphasized largely, because you guys are the Agriculture Policy Committee, things related to agriculture here. By no means are our groundwater challenges just agricultural in nature. So what I've tried to close every presentation that I've done with on this topic is that we think about managing our water, right? We're talking about managing it sustainably. Some of the innovations that we can think about, where we can go, right? I just tried to capture, you know, the ones that come to my mind easily. And that is, we can always use less, right? Just don't use any more than we need. And there's lots of things we can do in terms of the types of toilets we have. There's a big difference between old toilets and new toilets and how much water they use. There's things we can do in our industrial process. There's all kinds of new technology that industrial users are exploring. The Met Council is working with the university, and they're looking at some stuff specifically in the North and East Metro groundwater management area to reduce water use. One of the things that is quietly going on is we've got miles and miles, probably millions of miles of pipes that distribute the water that we pull out of the ground and send out to go do something. And you know what happens over time? Pipes leak. Well, when they're underground, you don't know about it unless it washes out the road and causes a sinkhole or something. But there are ways to detect how much water is leaking out of pipes. Many municipalities do this. Many don't. Many local small community water suppliers don't have the funds to do it, even if it only costs $2,000, which it does. It's not very expensive. They hook up these electronic gizmos. Oh, you got leaks. Where are they? Oh, it's there. Okay, let's go fix that leak. We see leak estimates of and detections of as much as 40% of the water that we've pumped out of the ground treated doesn't ever make it to its destination. Some of the better municipalities in that regard, Rochester and many in the Twin Cities, have managed their leaks at 5% or less, which is, you know, 10% is sort of considered the gold standard by the American Public Water Works. But we also, I've mentioned irrigation scheduling. There are some opportunities to just figure out when to turn it on, so you don't do it sooner or later than is necessary, but when to turn it on. And we know that many people take advantage of this, but many others are not. There's also, as Representative Hamilton was talking about, crop selection can make a big difference here. Changes in rotation, you know, adding another low water use crop once in 4 years could change the total amount of water used in that area incrementally, right? That's on the demand side. On the supply side, we can diversify our sources. We've got some big rivers that run a lot of water through the metropolitan area in particular, but in other places. We could utilize our surface waters more, but we could also keep our groundwater for the times when the surface waters are low. But that's an infrastructure choice, and it's a cost, but it's a choice that we could make. we can share systems. So we're hearing about this in municipalities where it's like, well, it's more efficient if we work together and we'll share our system. We can do things like stormwater management. We're talking about drainage impacts, but stormwater, when water runs off our impervious surfaces and all we do is send it down the pipe to the next pipe to the discharge point in the river, we've missed an opportunity to keep that water here and have it do something for us, like recharge our groundwater, irrigate our landscapes. There are a number of communities now that are implementing stormwater capture, recharge, and use systems. They're using stormwater to irrigate golf courses in Woodbury and Hugo, as an example. Urban parks. They've got storage tanks underneath, so when they rebuild streets and stuff, they're building these with an actual tank to hold that water, so when it doesn't rain, that's what they use rather than groundwater. We have lots of opportunities to think about that we can do to implement these sort of systems. And then there's reuse of treated water. We put a lot of water into treatment systems, we clean that water up, and then we send it on its way. And the saying is, what if we could get it to do one more job for us? Just one more. An outside job. We don't want to drink it necessarily, although they do have systems in California to do that. But get it to do one more job for us along the way. We could really reduce the burden we put on our groundwater resources and help us maintain sustainability over time. So that's the hopeful message at the end of all the opportunities we have. I can stand for more questions.
We have a couple of questions. I guess I would, first of all, ask you, lofty goals, good goals, do you think those can be done through voluntary efforts and done more at the local level, Mr. Meckel?
Mr. Chairman, if I could follow up, voluntarily meet the goals of sustainability or voluntarily do some of the things that are on, like this, for example?
Meet the goals of sustainability.
I would answer that I think that people could implement all kinds of things voluntarily. And to the extent that we do that, that's great. But we still might find that all of the best intentions, there'll be more demand than what is sustainably available. So in that case, we have to use our regulatory authority to say, this is how much we can sustainably pump. If this is the limit, how do we figure out of a community of users to live within that limit? How do we utilize that water? What are our highest priorities? If I'm in a community, do I want to invest in an ethanol plant, or do I want that for some industry? Do I want it to go to agriculture in my area? Do I want it to go to my homes? But we have to figure out what the sustainable limit is. We're not going to figure that out just voluntarily. We need the data to figure that out. But how we get there, lots of room, lots of opportunity for what the path looks like. But we have to know what the limit is to reach the goal.
Representative Hansen.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Last night I attended a sewer fair in my district. And next time we have a sewer fair, I'll...
You didn't ask us to go along.
I should have had a little more lead time. But it was about 75 people in West St. Paul showed up to learn about old pipes. I mean, we've got old pipes, and Mr. Meckel was talking about that. So I'll get that on the calendar the next sewer fair we have, Mr. Chair. But Mr. Meckel, I'm wondering if you could get to the committee or both committees, and I appreciate the ability for the Finance Committee to sit in on this. Maybe a list of the irrigation permits being requested or that have been approved along the Lewis and Clark route in southwestern Minnesota. Just what we're seeing for demand there, both municipal and agricultural, to try to get a better handle on water, water demands coming up, because I think we're going to continue to have some requests.
Hey, got that, Mr. Meckel?
I do. Thank you.
We have some other testifiers to come up. Just one final question, Mr. Meckel. Going back to the brewery thing, is that situation unique because of the trout stream, or does that make the situation different, more difficult?
Mr. Chairman, in reality, all surface water systems are potentially impacted by the same thing that's going on with Cold Spring Creek, right? If I take so much water away from a stream, its ability to support whatever species occupies it is diminished at some point if we take the water away. So whether it's a trout stream or not, the statutes don't say that we only do this for trout streams. The statutes say surface waters. The fact that it's a trout stream means that it's a little bit more sensitive because the groundwater relationship to trout streams is more prominent. Where we have trout streams, we typically have more groundwater, and groundwater plays a stronger role in the system. So the fact that we have some of these issues around trout streams is because of the nature of the local geology. But all surface waters are potentially negatively impacted by over-appropriating, overusing the water in the area.
But yet, point of emphasis is on trout stream areas and fen areas, correct?
Well, Mr. Chairman, and that goes back to my urgency room analysis, that those being some of the more sensitive, the ones that are, you know, the old phrase, the canaries in the coal mine, you know, you're focusing energy on the places that you think are going to be impacted first. And with limited resources, we've chosen to focus there because that's where the issues are. That doesn't mean we don't have to look other places, but we're trying to use the information we have to help us focus our energy and our time and our expertise and our financial resources.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity and committee members for your attention.
Very complete report. Thank you again. Next testifiers, please come down. We have about 20 minutes left. Welcome, and please identify yourselves for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bruce Clayman. I represent the Minnesota Irrigators Association. And now I need cheaters. Mr. Chairman, we've had a couple guests come in from out of town, so I want to make sure we hear from them. A couple of preliminary comments I want to let the committee know before we start that haven't come up today. And this benefit for mostly for the new members. The groundwater management authority that we're talking about has not been brought up yet today. That came in 2010. This idea that the department can just establish a groundwater management area somewhere. There's not a lot of guidelines in that. So this is not old water law. This was not part of the Groundwater Act of 89. This came in 2010. And so that's where their authority, at least from my research, shows that their authority first came, where they could establish these areas. So that's not new. We're all still trying to get our arms around what all this means and how it's going to work out. Okay, so it's new stuff. We also seem to have this conversation be accelerated by the drought in 2012. The drought in 2012 really sort of stepped up the conversation. But then we had a pretty wet spring this year, a lot of prevented plant acres. My own brother had a couple of quarters that he never got in, even in June, with late plant beans because it was too wet. So now we've gone kind of the other way. So this always seems to be a moving target, as Mr. Meckel kind of brought up. Things change. They ebb and flow. And then just another thing for the new members here, and then I'll turn it over to Ann. In the last 2 years, we've seen a number of groundwater items come out of the legislature. Many of them have not been adopted, but I was sitting here just jotting down probably a dozen of them as I was sitting here. In addition to the Groundwater Management Authority, we've had the preliminary approval process Mr. Meckel had mentioned, the sustainability standard. We had the authority for APOs, administrative penalty orders. That was last year. The DNR was successful in extending their permit approval time from 30 days up to 150. We used to have to approve a permit in 30 days, and last year that was changed up to 150. Now, the administration's goal on permits is 90 days. On the growing season on 185-day corn is 185 days. So that was an issue for us last year. That was a change. There was a penalty for timely reporting. Two things we liked from last year were the negative declaration language, meaning that there had to be a negative approved on a surface water area. We worked with the department on that. That was a change. The advisory council membership, that was not part of the original groundwater management in 2010. That was a piece we got with the department last year. There's been fee increases. There have been proposed fee increases that have not passed. There have been the trout stream conversation. And then lastly, the proposer may have to pay for a monitoring well. So if you got eight people drawing off an aquifer and a ninth one comes in with a new irrigator, they could assess that person for the new monitoring well and stick the cost. Now, we've had conversations with the department about sharing that, but it gets to be an issue of collection. How do you collect from eight of your neighbors when you're the ninth guy? So we've had a lot of conversation for the new members about groundwater in the last 2 years, and these are the things that I could remember. With that, Mr. Chairman, we have a couple of members here. You listed Alan Peterson in the on the agenda. He's the president of the Irrigators Association, and we were able to get Jim Anderson, who is a member of the advisory committee in the Bonanza Valley. So he's been sitting on the committee and can tell you about his experience there. So with that, I'll turn it over to them.
Thanks. Good morning and welcome, and let's hear from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Alan Peterson. I farm in Sherburne County, right north of the Twin Cities metro area. Clear Lake is my actual address. My wife and I farm. My oldest son joined the operation 3 years ago, so we definitely are a definition of a family farm. I've been the Irrigators Association of Minnesota state president for about 12 or 13 years. I keep trying to get off, but nobody will run for my spot. We have approximately 450 members. When I first got on, our membership was quite low. But as anybody who is part of an organization, as issues start to arise, membership, it tends to help membership. That's a good and a bad thing. So our membership is creeping up there, and I'm glad of that. As the Irrigators Association, we try to stay very engaged with the DNR. We meet with them periodically, one, two, three times a year. The DNR is, we are directly connected. We have to apply for irrigation permits. We report usage to them. They are kind of our overseer as an irrigator. And I've always thought that since issues start to arise, it's very good to keep that line of communication open. And we do have a very nice line. When we sit down and meet, we can have an open discussion. As an Irrigators Association, we encourage wise use of irrigation water. As an irrigator, it doesn't do me any good to overpump. I have some crops that if you overwater them, they actually do worse than if you underwater them. So it's expensive to irrigate, to over-irrigate. I always try to get that point across. My area, I have Conexus Energy as my, I have all irrigation that I use for powering my irrigators and my pumps. We just got done with the second year of a 3 year 9% per year rate increase. So if you do the math after 3 years, that's not 27, it's more like 35% rate increase. Mr. Meckel alluded to well interference. They fielded a few questions from the committee. Well interference issues are a very complicated issue. As the DNR and IAM, all we differ on the DNR's investigations of certain interference claims, and we always have a pretty nice discussion about some of those whenever we meet. So, with that, I'll stop there. So,
any questions from members? Okay, next testifier.
Chairman Anderson and members of the Ag Policy Committee. My name is Jim Anderson. I farm with my family, with my brother and then three sons in a diversified irrigated farming operation with both crops and hogs and cattle. We live in the Bonanza Valley, which is one of the three designated groundwater management areas. And it's an irrigated area that goes from about Painesville on the east end up to Glenwood on the west end, the southern edge being like Sibley Park, and then going north about 20 miles. So I think as far as acreage, it's probably right around 450,000 acres in the total watershed we've identified, and about 75 to 80,000 acres of those are irrigated. I became a member of the groundwater management area a year ago in January. Initially, I was the only irrigator on the committee. Kind of felt like a black sheep, you know, and anyway, and I thank the legislature for making it mandatory that at least half of the committee members were stakeholders. In other words, they had to have a permit in that area. We have met monthly, almost every month, very interesting meetings, shared a lot of data, a lot of information, a lot of different ideas are coming out as far as not only goals but recommendations how to go forward. I guess, as personally, the reason I'm very interested in this whole project is that, number one, I want water to be sustainable. I want my kids to irrigate just as much as I have been able to the last 45 years. Before, when I was growing up, we very seldom raised a crop where I live. Usually it would go pretty nice until about the 4th of July and then quit raining, and a lot of times the corn wouldn't even set an ear out in August. So one of the things that we've been doing, and actually my grandfather was involved in some of the DNR work in the early years, is doing groundwater monitoring. And we Jason talked about all the monitoring wells we have. I pulled up, there are three shallow wells, or three superficial aquifer wells that are on the back side of this sheet of paper that was handed out. The top one would be a well over by the, in the Sedan area, and it was monitored since 1967 up to present. On the left-hand side shows the depth below the ground level where the water was taken. I think if you follow the graph along, you'll see the years like 1988 was probably the low year, again, a very droughty year. 1986, when our family's basement was had 2 feet of water in, it was like a swimming pool, was a very wet year. So again, the superficial groundwater, the water above the clay layer, follows precipitation trends very closely. And also, I might mention, this is a very good indicator of wetland levels and lake levels and stream levels, too. The second graph is a graph of a artesian deep well. And these are wells dug beyond the initial clay layer to a depth of maybe 60 to 200 feet deep. This particular well, I think the aquifer is like 125 feet deep. So you can see the graph. In the spring time, it's been very consistent at 30 feet below the top of the ground. On the years of droughts, 1988, 2007, and 2012, probably had the deepest late August drawdown of any of the graphs. So I think, you know, some people say that you see these deep spikes in the middle of summer. I guess my take on it is, if you look at the spring recharge levels, they maintain pretty much constant rate over the past 30 years, whereas the Nebraska models, you'll see a definite decline in spring levels. The third graph, and this is the graph that most people see or are concerned about, is what are lake levels doing. I pulled up the one that was monitored the longest time in our area is Lake Minnewaska, and I think most of you are probably familiar with that lake. It's a lake that runs from Glenwood to Starbuck, very pristine lake. They have water levels from 1935 to the present. In 1935, when they first took the first measurement, the water level is about 9 feet below what it's been for the last 30 years. And I remind you, back in 1935, there was not a whole lot of irrigation in the Bonanza Valley. So, and the other thing, too, on the 4th of July, I wanted to go water skiing on the same lake, and they wouldn't let me because the water levels were too high, I think. So anyway, we want to make sure these graphs stay like this. We want to make sure we have sustainable water supplies into the future. Again, the second point is that irrigation... we want to make sure irrigation can continue to provide increased crop production and the ability to grow high-value specialty crops in the droughty, sandy soils of Bonanza Valley. Without irrigation, our family would not be farming. I'd probably have a different line of work. I know my kids would not be farming. So very important to our area, adds a lot of economic development in our whole area. The third thing is that we do not want to degrade water quality. And I think Jason mentioned many things like that too. And I, you know, we want to be able to use the same water that they use for drinking water for our livestock that would have no nitrates in. We want to do things that we can accomplish this by best management farming practices and many different ways. Recommendations then, and very similar to what Jason said, was that we'd like to continue monitoring to determine long-term trends. And I don't think we can determine like a six-month trend or like a 2012 or 1988 drought and say there's no water left. We need long-term 30 or 40 or 50-year trends. We encourage all of our neighbors to have, and the DNR basically demands it, that all irrigation wells have permits and water usage is reported every year accurately. We want to promote water conservation and adoption of new irrigation technologies. Jason mentioned some of the things like irrigation scheduling. On the newer parts, they have these variable rate irrigators where actually we save probably 30% or 40% of the water by targeting our irrigation as that pivot goes around the field to just the sandy, droughty areas and not putting very much water in the depressions. I guess lastly, I'd like to say that, and I think Jason kind of mentioned that too, that we are going to try to set up a committee that meets ongoing to take and review these trends and then recommend actions. And again, as irrigators, we as local people want to be a part of this. We don't want the state, somebody from St. Paul telling us what we need to do with our water, but we want to be part of this whole process. So, I guess the other thing that most of us feel on this committee is that we need to plan for what would happen if we have a 1930 style drought, and Lake Manawaska, even without irrigation, was down 10 feet below where it is today. No matter all the laws you can write, you probably can't prevent a lake from going dry or a wetland from going dry or trout stream from drying up if there's no water coming down. So I guess that's what all I have.
Mr. Anderson, thank you. And I attended a couple of those meetings up in the Bonanza Valley, and they start at 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning and run till noon or after. You put a lot of time into it from day one. So thank you for serving and working to get more on-the-ground folks on the committee. So thank you. Thank you all for your work. Questions, Mr. Representative Hamilton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the testifiers, thank you for everything that you do. Agriculture is a noble, noble profession, so I appreciate that. And I just find it a little ironic. Never have we had to fight so hard to try to feed people in recent history, at least. And so my simple question to you two is, why do you do it? Why are you engaged in agriculture? Why do you do it?
I guess you don't know any better. All right, Chairman Anderson. Okay. Yeah. No, I shouldn't say it that way. But it's, you know, I've farmed ever since I got out of college in 1975, and I feel like I've never worked a day in my life. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's, you know, what else could you say, you know?
Thank you. Representative Hamilton, I farmed right out of, I only went to a two-year vocational school farm management program. I got involved with the Irrigators Association. We started to irrigate in 1976, so that was before I graduated, so I'm dating myself a little bit. And I concur with what Jim said. Without irrigation, I would not be farming. Last year, I hosted the Ag Commissioner on a tour at my farm in August, and we went to an irrigated field and a dryland field. And I don't know if any of you happened to see some of the nice, we got some very nice stories. There was no corn in the dryland field. There was a nice crop in the irrigated field. And that's why I do it. I need the ability to irrigate, to be sustainable and in economically sustainable. I now have my oldest son farming with me. My youngest son has commented a little bit that maybe in the future he'd like to. He's graduated from college and has another job at the moment. But I'm looking down the road, and that's why I do it. It's not for the high pay.
One quick comment to Mr. Anderson or question. You talked about the size of the Bonanza Valley. In the last few years have been relatively good in terms of crop prices and such, a lot of permits. Is there a lot of additional land available that would be suitable for irrigation looking down the road? Do you think this trend of increasing numbers of permit applications is going to continue?
Well, I won't say that there will not be any new applications, but most of the applications that I think are coming in now would be for a smaller acreage. In other words, the nice square quarter sections are pretty well all developed, and there may be a small 25 or 30 or 40 acre field that maybe could come in. But I think when they did the initial study back in the early 60s, they estimated maybe 100,000 acres were available. to be irrigated, and I guess we're about 80% there right now. So,
okay, thank you.
I think the other thing too, Chairman Anderson, is that and committee that members that crop prices have a huge impact on what gets developed and what doesn't. So, like during the 80s, when we had low prices, very little development was taken on. In fact, it was probably going decreasing some land going back in the CRP. And if we, you know, the last 3 or 4 or 5 years have been the best years of my farming life as far as economic wise and stuff. And that's why we see the huge interest in developing irrigated fields.
And that's changed the last year or so, at least the economics. Did we get all the questions answered, Mr. Representative Lewick? Did we get to yours? Okay, I missed it. Hang on just a second here. Okay. Next meeting coming up with the Chair Hamilton will be a joint meeting again tomorrow, same time, 10:15. Joint meeting. We'll be discussing AURI and have a presentation from Marl as well. But thanks for a good informational hearing today. And with that, we'll be adjourned.